Ford's evening keynote the past couple years at this conference has always been a huge highlight for us. Over the past few years, you've seen this management team highlight just a tremendous product transformation. Anybody that's watched this over the past 5, 6, 7 years, I think all of us would agree that it's simply been remarkable. This year, the presentation, I think, will have a little bit of a different focus. I think clearly given macro questions and questions about new mobility platforms, questions about new technologies, I think people are asking much more probing and longer-term questions. And I think for those of you that know this management team, you know that they've always been, I think always been amongst the most strategic and thoughtful and insightful leaders in this industry. And this evening, we're very much looking forward to hearing about some of Ford's both near-term financial as well as longer-term strategic plans. And with that introduction, I'm very pleased to welcome Mark Field, CEO of Ford Motor Company.
Okay, good evening, everybody. I'm the dinner entertainment. So we figure we just show this slide. That's the only slide we're going to show, and how many orders, and then we'll take care of next year. Well, first off, it's really a pleasure to be with you again this evening, and we really wanted to use this as an opportunity to continue to tell our One Ford story. And although we're still racking up the final numbers, what I can tell you is that for 2015, it will extend our streak, and we will have a sixth year in a row of very strong and consistent financial performance. And I think this gives us a very good platform to build on as we look to lead in our core business, but also at the same time taking advantage of these emerging opportunities in the mobility space, which is really enabled by technology. And you can see from some of the announcements we've made in CES and here over the last couple of days our approach to doing that. So, as we get forward, what I'll do is start talking about 2015. And again, like I said, we still haven't racked up all the numbers, but I think it's going to give you a very good sense of where we ended up for the year and where we're coming out. So as a company, we are staying focused on these areas, on driving growth, returns, improving risk profile, and rewards. Because we know that companies that do this well and do this consistently create value. And I'm pleased to say that in 2015, we made very good progress in each and one of these areas. So what I'd like to do is take you through that. So let's take a look at growth. In 2015, the company's wholesale volume, our automotive revenue, and our global market share all grew. And you can see here our wholesale volume was the highest since 2005. Our revenue was the highest since 2007, and our global market share grew 0.2 percentage points to 7.3% on the back of a lot of the new products that we've been introducing over the last 18 months. Importantly, we also saw growth at Ford Credit in terms of receivables, which is consistent with Ford's Credit's mission to support the sales and growth of our automobiles. But also at the same time, Ford Credit's global share of financing increased across the world, which is a good accomplishment. Turning now to looking at returns, I would just simply put it this way. Our financial performance in 2015 was outstanding. We set an all-time record for company pre-tax profit. Our automotive operating margin was the highest since the 1990s. Our automotive operating related cash flow was the highest since 2001. And our corporate after-tax return on invested capital was healthy. It was well above our cost of capital, and it was higher than 2014. Moving on to risk, I think we've also continued to make very good progress in improving the risk profile of the company. And within that, every business unit in 2015 was profitable with the exception of South America. If you look at Europe, our operations in Europe achieved its first annual profit since 2011 and fulfilled the original commitment of our European transformation plan, which we put in place back in 2012, where we said the objective was to be profitable in 2015. Our overall break-even volume as a percent of our wholesale volumes was healthy, and importantly in our North American market, which is our largest and most profitable unit, is at or better than its target of 2/3 of wholesale volume. And with this level, we think we are better prepared, better prepared in the case of the next downturn. If you look at our cash and liquidity, it remains strong and above our levels of $20 billion in cash and $30 billion of liquidity. And again, this also provides us to protect us against downturns and any kind of outside, you know, exogenous event that could hit our industry. If you look at our balance sheet, we strengthen it, and the leverage metrics are actually consistent with single A credit rating. And along with that, our global funded pension plans are now nearly fully funded and de-risked. And as you know from the last couple of sessions we've had you over the years, that's been a strategic objective of ours, and we put in a strategy to do that. And if we look at Ford Credit, the loan portfolio continued to perform extremely well. Credit losses and repossessions were at historic lows or near historic lows. And our return on equity was higher than our target of 10%. And our managed leverage was just a touch above our 8-to-9-to-1 objective. Moving on, taking a look at the rewards, if you think about the strong performance that we've had since 2010 and the strong performance we've had in 2015, we continue to reward our shareholders. With distributions during the year in 2015 totaled $2.5 billion, and with the regular dividend representing an annual increase of 20%. But also, more broadly, you can see the other stakeholders here. You know, our strategy has been one of profitable growth for all. And you can see our customers, our employees, our dealers, our suppliers, and the communities in which we live and work have been benefiting as well. Now, 2015 was also a very important and noteworthy year from an operational standpoint. And you can see some of the achievements here. Last year on this stage, we said we were going to launch 16 global products, and I'm very proud of the team's performance in being able to do that successfully. We completed the last of the 10 plants that we committed to building as part of our Asia-Pacific growth strategy. Our quality improved in every region around the world and is actually, based on our internal metrics, at historic lows in terms of good quality. And at the same time, J.D. Power rated our Ford Credit operation as the number one in customer satisfaction, both in the mainstream brands, but also luxury brands as well. We successfully completed the UAW agreement and the four-year agreement, and it resulted in labor costs, which will grow less than 1.5% during the length of the agreement. We also maintained the operational flexibility to be able to respond to any changes in market demand. And also, at the same time, stepping back, we improved the overall competitiveness of our North America business. We also announced plans, you may have seen this right before the break, where we're going to be investing $4.5 billion in electrified vehicle solutions between now and the end of the decade. And what that will do is build on the leadership that we have now in terms of the breadth of product, and we'll be launching 13 new electrified products by the end of the decade. And when you stand back and look at our global nameplates, about 40% of our nameplates around the world will be electrified. We also reached a milestone with Sync. We now have over 15 million Sync-equipped vehicles around the globe. And also at the same time, we continued to position the company to be an auto and a mobility company. And we launched our Ford Smart Mobility strategy this time last year, and a number of experiments, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But that's really about being very aggressive in looking at these opportunities and marrying it with the technological enablers that are out there, and we're learning a lot. So this is a very exciting time for our company, and in 2016, we plan to further strengthen the business, the automotive business, making very meaningful but also concrete progress in the emerging market space or the emerging mobility space. And as we do this, we're going to stay very focused on our three priorities, which is around accelerating the pace of progress of our One Ford plan, which has served us very well, delivering product excellence with passion, and then driving innovation into every part of our business. So I kind of think about our strategy as having one foot in today and one foot in tomorrow. So what do I mean by that? One foot in today is about delivering this month's sales, this quarter's financials, this year's objectives, and one foot in the future, which is really having a point of view of what we think the world will look like 5, 10, and even 15 years out, and be able to interpret or predict what we think that will be, and then understand what could be the impact to our business. And then what are the things that we have to do from a strategy standpoint, rolling back to today, to put us in a good position to thrive in that period of time? So using the framework that I started with earlier, what does that mean for us? Well, it means continuing to invest and grow in our businesses, both in our core business, but also in these emerging opportunities. It means continuing to strengthen our results, continuing to improve our risk profile as a company, and of course, continuing to reward our shareholders and also all the stakeholders associated with Ford. But let me bring it. First off, everything always starts with focusing on, investing in, and keeping our core automotive business strong. And that's all about designing, developing, manufacturing, and marketing terrific cars, SUVs, trucks, and electrified vehicles. And within that, that also this year includes launching 12 new global products, and I'll say more about that a little later in the presentation. And if you think about it, with the 16 global products that we launched last year, combined with the 12 we're launching this year, about 45% of our wholesale volume in 2016 is going to be about products, come from products that we've launched just since the beginning of last year. Now, at the same time, we know that the industry is changing and evolving very, very fast. The clock speed and what's happening in our business is pretty amazing, even versus 3 years ago or 5 years ago. And you can see some of the elements on here. It's around new forms of mobility. It's around new customer experiences. It's about, you know, things like new competitors, non-traditional competitors we never thought would be interested in the car business. It's vehicles that are being, you know, part of becoming part of the Internet of Things. And it's also about the ability to gain real good insights into all this data that we could be collecting, as long as customers give us permission to provide insights about what they tell us they want, and also what we can interpret of what they may want. And of course, the advent of autonomous vehicles, which has been getting, obviously a lot of interest over the last number of months and even the first 2 weeks of this year between CES and the show. And when you look at this kind of change in any industry, as a business, you could look at it as a huge risk or an opportunity. And one of the things I'd like to communicate to you, that myself and the rest of my colleagues at Ford, we look at this as a huge opportunity for us. So let me just dimension what we think that opportunity is. The left-hand side of this slide here shows our traditional automotive business, all brands around the world. And that's about a $2.3 trillion business. And at Ford, we get about 6% of that. The right-hand side there is transportation services. So think about mass transit, think about taxis, think about sharing, car sharing, you know, ground-based transportation. It doesn't include, you know, airlines and those type of things. That's about a $5.4 trillion revenue business. And at Ford, as well as the rest of our competitors, we virtually get none of that. And oh, by the way, that $5.4 trillion is going to grow over the next 15 years when you look at a number of the societal factors. So that is about to change for us because we see being an auto and a mobility company as a massive opportunity for us and one that we're very serious about investing in innovating in, and also in leading in. Now, at the same time for us, mobility goes even deeper. Every company has to have a why. And if you go back to our founder, Henry Ford, he put the world on wheels, and he was driven not only to create a strong business, but also a better world. And that's why mobility to us as a company is it's about human progress. And when you think about it, it's about giving people the freedom to live, to work, and to play where they want. And it's about making people's lives better and changing the way the world moves, which is what our founder originally founded our company on. And that's why this is not just a buzzword for us. It cuts right to who we are as a company and why many of us joined the company. But our interpretation of this is on this chart here is what we call Ford Smart Mobility. And we're thinking about this holistically. We're not just thinking about, oh, it's about an autonomous car, or gee, it's about a ride-sharing service. This is about how people live their lives. So it's an opportunity to keep customers connected to their lives 24/7. It gives customers what they want before they may even know they want it, right, by using data and analytics. It gives the ability for our customers to go where they want to go, regardless of how they got there. It's empowering customers to be able to allow them to drive somewhere, or even if they choose not to drive, like with an autonomous vehicle. And finally, it's about giving them an experience that binds them to the company and integrates with their life and makes their lives easier. So this is how we think about mobility, and we call it Ford Smart Mobility in a holistic sense. Now, this graphic, we showed this graphic for the first time at the show yesterday, and we've been working with this graphic internally in the company for quite some time now. And I think it really puts into perspective how we're thinking about this opportunity. And first off, the left-hand side, it emphasizes why it's so important to continue to fund and be excellent at a core business. Right, designing, developing, and manufacturing, marketing, just terrific vehicles. And then the emerging opportunities and what we call Ford Smart Mobility, you know, how that is growing and how by working these two, we can have a much stronger company. And you see we use the infinity circle. And the reason we do that is because by definition, infinity says it could be without limit. But importantly, it's interconnected. One can feed the other. And this is not about moving from an old business to a new business. This is just moving to a bigger business. And how do we as an organization take advantage of that? And that little kind of light blue area around there that says customer experience, I think this reminds us of the importance of the customer experience and how technology is fundamentally changing that. And those companies that can embrace that and use that technology and use that data to make people's lives better, well beyond just the initial purchase of the vehicle or the initial use of a service, those are the companies that are going to win. And when we do that, I think we're going to have an even stronger business. And our ultimate objective, again, is to provide mobility solutions to our customers to make their lives better. So this is how we're thinking about it. Oops, you go back one. So let's just talk about this because it is amazing to see how things are changing and evolving in our business, right? Like I said, look at all the announcements just at CES and the show over the last couple of days. And I think it's really showing how investing in both of these, the core business and the emerging opportunities, is so important. And that's why last year, when we announced Ford Smart Mobility, we announced 25 to 30 experiments that we were launching. And we learned a lot from that. And we're learning a lot, and we're turning some of those into pilots, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But also at the same time, we announced Sync Connect, which is starting with the Escape. We are going to be putting a 4G LTE modem in our vehicles, and that will allow the vehicle to be connected. And by the end of the decade, we'll have approximately 10 million vehicles around the globe with Sync Connect. We also announced that we were going to be adding Apple CarPlay and Android Auto to give our customers choice on the type of devices they want to use in their vehicle. We're also on the autonomous vehicle front. We're testing in M-City, which is the University of Michigan simulated in urban environment. We also just got our driver's license, our permit in California, to be able to be testing on the roads there in California. We announced last week that we're tripling our autonomous vehicle development fleet, so we will have the largest development fleet in the industry. So we're doing a lot of things in that area. Also today we announced, or yesterday, we announced that we were the first OEM to be testing autonomous vehicles in the snow. And we used the last couple of days to rack up some miles. And I know it's a little bit, sometimes, probably a little difficult to get into the airport, but our autonomous vehicles were on the job. Now, let me get back to the experiments. We learned a lot, and we ended up focusing on two areas, what we call flexible use and ownership and multimodal urban mobility solutions, which kind of rolls off the tongue. But that is essentially how do you integrate different modes of transportation to enable people to either get in and out of a city or across a city. And we're doing a number of pilots. We're in that regard. For example, we announced that Ford Credit is doing a very innovative leasing where 3 to 6 customers can actually share a lease. And that opens up, you know, new customer bases for us. Let's say, you know, you live in a neighborhood and there's 4 or 5 people that would love to use a pickup truck every now and then. Gee, all of a sudden now you can. And we have an app that will allow you to manage that. Or you're in a household with multiple drivers. We also announced another pilot with our Lincoln customers, where those customers can actually get credit for their unused leasing miles and use that as towards their next purchase or lease of a Ford vehicle. So we're learning of these experiments, we're turning them into pilots, and in some cases we'll be turning these into businesses that not only impact the emerging opportunities, but actually help the core business. We're also at the same time, we announced yesterday what we call Ford Pass. And this is our opportunity to really look at the customer experience, as we talked about earlier, and really revolutionize it for us. And essentially, it's a platform, a digital and a physical platform, to really enhance that customer experience. Think of it this way. Think about when Apple had their iPod, right? It was a great device. But what really revolutionized the customer experience was when they introduced iTunes. And then they could have a different relationship in terms of how they buy their music, how they listen to their music, etc. That's what we want Ford Pass to do for our customers' relationship. And we're opening it up to our customers that own vehicles, but also non-customers as well. Also, so bottom line is we're going to have a lot more to say about Ford Smart Mobility in 2016. But as we think about 2016, our results are going to continue to be powered by our core business. So let me take you through some information for the year ahead. So we expect this to be another outstanding year for our company, one that's going to feature growth, also at the same time sustained strong financial performance. Also profitability across all of our business units with the exception of South America, continued strong balance sheet, and as well the next stage of the deployment of our shareholder distribution strategy. And as we look across the patch around the world from this slide on the business environment, generally we see the conditions still favorable for moderate growth in GDP, but also in the automotive industry. And if you look at regionally, we expect the U.S. to continue to be strong. We expect Europe and China to have moderate growth. And in South America, Well, we're likely to see lower industries as the recession in Brazil deepens, but also at the same time as the new government in Argentina takes the structural reform actions to position that country for growth later on. We also expect at the same time commodity prices to be continue to be weak, or we would call it lower for longer. And if you look at the year-over-year basis, we expect this year to have a less favorable year-over-year impact from 15 to 16 than the previous year. Also, at the same time, we do expect the dollar to continue to remain strong. And again, it will have a larger adverse year-over-year impact on our business, 15 to 16, than it did the year ago. So that's our view of the business environment, the industry, and the GDPs. Now, 2016 is going to be another very active year for our teams around the world, launching great vehicles, both Ford and Lincoln. We will be launching, we'll be strengthening our already strong pickup truck lineup with the launch of our new Super Duty in Kentucky, in our Kentucky plant, and that will happen in the fall. We also showed at the show yesterday our F-150 Raptor, in both a super cab and a crew cab version, and we'll also be launching the limited series of F-150. The Ford brand is going to be launching two very important high-volume products, the new Escape and the Fusion. And the Escape is going to feature two new EcoBoost engines, and also it's going to be the first vehicle that has our Sync Connect system, which is the 4G LTE modem. Also, our Fusion, when you get a chance to see it at the show, it's going to be the fastest, it's going to be the broadest lineup we've introduced, and also the most technology-packed one as well. And, of course, it includes multiple powertrains, not only our EcoBoost powertrains, but hybrid and a plug-in hybrid as well, and some really neat features like adaptive cruise control with pedestrian protection. And that will actually, if a pedestrian is in the road, it will warn you, and even if you don't react, the vehicle will actually stop to protect you and the pedestrian. And finally, of course, we're going to be launching a vehicle you probably have not heard of, which is the Ford GT, which will be coming a little later this year. Now, moving on to Lincoln, we're going to be launching both the Lincoln MKZ and the Lincoln Continental. And the MKZ, which you can see over here, shows the new face of Lincoln, but also features a new 400-horsepower EcoBoost engine, and also at the same time the Revel audio system. And if you have not had a chance to hear the Revel system, it is pretty amazing. And the new Continental, which we launched today at the show, this is really epitomizes where we're heading with Lincoln in what we call quiet luxury. And what we mean by that is luxury that's delivered with an elegance, with a serenity, and with an effortless power for customers who really crave great craftsmanship, but also crave warm human touches in a contemporary design. And we really spent a lot of time thinking about the user experience, and also with this quiet luxury, how is that relevant and differentiated from some of our competitors? And at the same time, we have some really neat features on it when you get a chance to see it. We have the light embrace, which the vehicle will actually greet you as you walk up to it, and the e-latch, which is integrated into the belt line of the vehicle. So your first tactile touch of the vehicle is very substantial and technical, but also connotes luxury. And we have something called the Lincoln Perfect Position Seats. So it's 30-weight seats. You can do anything in this seat. Well, maybe not anything, but you can do a lot of things in this seat. And it will actually conform to your body. So a lot of cool, and we also have as well a 3.0-liter V6 twin-turbo engine, which is unique to Lincoln. So we're really excited about that. And then, of course, a full lineup of electrified vehicles. We'll be launching the Focus battery electric vehicle, new update to that, which will have the DC fast charging system, which essentially allows you to charge 80% of the battery in 30 minutes and get about 100-mile range. And, of course, we'll have the HEVs, or the hybrids and the plug-in hybrids, for both Fusion and Mondeo and Lincoln MKZ. So a lot on our plate for launches, but something that the team is up for. Now, we expect to continue the company's strong financial performance in 2016, as I mentioned, and this includes, as you can see on the chart here, automotive revenue that will be equal to or higher than 2015, an operating margin that will be equal to or higher. Looking at our automotive operating cash flow, that will be lower than 2015's record cash flow, and that's really due to some timing differences, unfavorable working capital changes, and some timing differences. And within that operating-related cash flow, we'll be spending about $7.7 billion on capital spending, which is slightly higher than 2015. Also, at the same time, the company pre-tax profit will be about equal to or higher than 2015's record. And on an operating earnings per share basis, we expect it to be equal to or higher than 2015, and that includes a higher tax rate in the low 30s. Now, let's take a look at some of the levers. And again, we expect to continue to invest to grow the business in 2016 and beyond, both the core business, but also these emerging opportunities. But as we do this, we intend to grow lean. And what does that mean? That means knowing what we want to invest in, where we're heading, and making sure we are investing the appropriate amount, not too much, not too little, but also at the same time to do that, to achieve our strategic objectives. And also at the same time, you know, anything beyond that is waste and has to get stamped out. But it also continues to mean to follow one of the main tenets of our One Ford plan, and that's to restructure businesses that have, you know, no path to profitability in the appropriate time frame, but also restructure those businesses that are no longer relevant for our future that we see for ourselves. It also means partnering with others where it's appropriate, and we'll get more aggressive on that. And it also requires that we continue to have a very key focus on our break-even levels and our operating leverage so that we can continue to improve that and make the business even more physically fit for an eventual downturn that may happen. So as you look at 2016, we expect favorable market factors, volume, mix, and net pricing, along with a very strong performance from our parts and service operation to positively affect our operating margin. Costs will increase, although they will increase less than 2015, and that's essentially driven by less of an increase in contribution costs as the rate of increase in the product costs will be less than we had in 2015. So those are the levers that are driving our margin. So let's take a look at the individual business units. And for 2016, we expect North America to continue its strong performance, including an operating margin of 9.5% or higher. We expect Europe, Middle East and Africa, and Asia Pacific to all be profitable. And within that, Europe and Asia Pacific results to improve versus 2015, and Middle East and Africa will be equal to or higher than last year. As you can see here, we expect other automotive to be a loss of $800 million for 2016, and we expect Ford Credit to continue their terrific performance and the pre-tax profit is expected to be equal to or higher than 2015. So I want to spend a little bit of time on return on invested capital, because that's a lot of discussion in the industry over the last couple of months on this, and we wanted to give you our point of view on that. As I mentioned earlier in the presentation, our corporate after-tax return on invested capital in 2015 was healthy and above our cost of capital. Or the way I would put it in very simple terms, our investments that we're making are paying off. And our metric, which we developed in collaboration with outside advisors, is what we call an all-in after-tax measure. It reflects the bottom-line return generated by the capital that we utilize, because our shareholders give us all their capital. So it's important that we account for that. And further, we show this, as you can see here, on a 5-year rolling average, and we think that's appropriate given our industry's product and investment cycles. And on this basis, as you can see from the chart, our return on invested capital has exceeded our cost of capital in the majority of the last 20 years. Now, if we apply the same all-in methodology that we're using to our industry peers, you can see that, you know, we compare favorably, and that the returns also are significantly higher than our domestic competitors since they emerged from bankruptcy. And the approach here is, we think our healthy returns on invested capital really reflect the consistent, strong financial performance that we've been able to deliver over the last number of years, but also the relatively efficient utilization of the capital compared to our peer group. And we know that this is important, this metric is important to our investors, and one, of course, that we consider carefully when we look at our overall business performance, but also at the same time as we make investment decisions in the company. Now, besides growth and returns, of course, the third element we've been talking about is making sure we continue to improve the risk profile of the company, and we expect to make further progress. And you can see some of the elements here. We want to, obviously, we'll be profitable in all of our business units, with the exception of South America, by keeping a healthy break-even, including a break-even at targeted levels in our important North America market. It's continuing to generate strong cash flow and keep our cash and liquidity balances above our targets. And, of course, it also includes making sure our balance sheet remains strong and really maintaining those single A credit rating metrics. At the same time, by completing the funding this year of our global funded pension plans in the aggregate, and also continuing to put in place an asset strategy that focuses on fixed income investments, that should largely offset some of the changes that we see in even asset returns or also any changes of the discount rate that may happen in the future. It also, improving the profile is looking at forward credit and keeping our managed receivables within our target or our managed leverage in our targeted range with a return on equity at our 10% or above target. And, of course, with a balance sheet that would self-liquidate in the case of an industry downturn. And, of course, finally, improving the risk profile of the company by moving aggressively into the smart mobility and the opportunities that may lead to us for additional revenue streams in the company, which could be less cyclical and also more consistent and potentially at some very good margins. Now, the success that we've had over the past 6 years has been underpinned by a very clear and transparent capital allocation framework that has been implemented on a consistent basis with a lot of discipline. And Bob and the team have been, I think, very, very diligent in keeping all of you up to speed on that. And I think a key part of this has been our shareholder distribution strategy. So since 2012, as you know, we've been paying regular dividends, and dividends that we expect to sustain through an economic and a business cycle, and dividends that have grown all the way through 2015. We also, at the same time, executed some share repurchase programs, and that's been for compensated-related stock-based compensation. And also, at the same time, if you recall, in 2014, we also were calling the settlement of the convertible debt. So now we have the opportunity in 2016 to further reward our shareholders. So today we're declaring a supplemental dividend of $1 billion, or 25 cents per share, in addition to our first quarter regular dividend of 15 cents per share. And we expect these annual supplemental dividends to be an ongoing element of our shareholder distribution strategy. And, you know, of course, we'll determine the amount of that supplemental dividend based on a variety of different factors. And this year's $1 billion supplemental dividend is based on our strong financial performance, our strong liquidity. And in future years, you know, the supplemental dividend, it may vary And in some years, we may not pay it at all, depending upon those factors. Subject also to board approval, we expect to maintain our regular dividend this year of overall 60 cents per share or 15 cents per quarter. And this would equate to $2.4 billion in distributions to our shareholders in 2016. We also plan, again, subject to the board approval, for the modest anti-dilutive share repurchase program. But also, if you stand back, our total shareholder distributions for 2016 will total $3.5 billion. And that's up 40% from last year's distributions. And if you think about it, our total shareholder distributions since 2012 totals $12.6 billion. So again, making sure we focus on the rewards. So a final comment before we wrap it up and I invite my colleagues to join me. You know, since our restructuring of North America and since getting through the 2008 and 2009 Great Recession, we have made a lot of progress as a company. We've grown our company substantially. We've strengthened our brand. We've simplified our product portfolio. And we've delivered outstanding quality as we've done that. We've consistently delivered strong financial results as a team. We've built a strong balance sheet. And we've improved the risk profile of the company. And just as importantly, we rewarded our shareholders and all the stakeholders that are associated with our business. And now we're positioning ourselves to transform the company from an auto company to an auto and a mobility company by embracing a lot of these, you know, enabling technologies that are basically opening up a whole new opportunity for us. So we know we have a lot of work in front of us. In 2015, we said a year ago that we were going to deliver a breakthrough year. And I couldn't be more proud of our team in delivering that breakthrough year. And we expect further progress in 2016. And I'm looking forward with my teammates to continuing to deliver that for our company. And so with that, that's the presentation. That's my report to the committee. And thank you. And we're going to end on that slide again, too. But what I'd love to do is invite my colleagues up to share in the Q&A, and we'll bring Bob Shanks, our Chief Financial Officer. We have John Casessa, our Group Vice President for Global Strategy. Joe Hinrichs, our Executive Vice President of the Americas. Stephen Odell, our Executive Vice President for Marketing, Sales, and Service. And Raj Nair, our Executive Vice President for Global Product Development and Chief Technical Officer and the holder of the longest title in Ford Motor Company for Vice Presidents. So,
okay, I'm going to kick it off.
Thanks.
I guess there's two things that I'd like to ask about. One would be if you can open the kimono a little bit on what your view is on 10 years from now and shared mobility. If you were to, you know, what's your current state of thinking on what markets might be affected, the percentage of the automotive market that might be affected, and what Ford brings to the table in that kind of an outlook? And secondly, I was hoping you can give us a little bit of that bridge that you typically give us on North America specifically, mm-hmm. since there seems to be a lot of moving parts with earnings flat and margins down a little bit, but it'd be great to get some insights into even the near-term outlook as well.
So on the smart mobility piece of it, how we're thinking about it, maybe I'll turn that over to John, who's working on this and leading this for us.
Hi, Rod. Look, we think there'll be profound changes. I mean, there's technology has either become available or become very cheap that enables you to do things with our products that you just couldn't do. I mean, cheap bandwidth, cheap storage, sensors, robotics. And so, you know, I think generally we feel what's going to happen is a car is going to get connected, it's going to get smart, and then eventually autonomous. And those will sort of coexist. So, you know, I think if you sort of take the logical conclusion of that, you can use the car to move people in a lot of different ways, people and goods. And our view on that is it enables us to expand our value proposition. Mark talked a little bit about the iPod, and you know, that's like the most spectacular example of a company with hardware attaching software to it to create music, right? That's what people want. But I think of much more prosaic examples. I think of Johnson Controls, which started with a thermostat and has a giant building controls business. So in general, we're thinking about a world in which there was, for our company, one way to move people. You bought our car, and we hope you liked it, you bought another one. But we can see a world where people ride in our cars, and they'll buy our cars, and they'll borrow our cars, will they be driven by them? We'll sell them a product, we'll sell them a service, or some combination thereof. And I think, you know, it's like one of the burning questions of, will that make the SAR go up, or will it make the SAR go down? We've done a lot of work on that, other people have as well. It's not so easy to answer that question. It really depends on the business model. You know, the argument, some of these technologies will take the cost per mile to move people down a lot. And when the price of a commodity goes down, the demand goes up. So we're not banking on that. I would say, you know, we don't have clarity on, you know, that SAR number 10 years from now from all these technology changes. But I think there's a good argument to make that it will be a very large market, larger, the market for mobility, larger than it is today, and that we'll have more choices to participate in that market. And I think as it relates to why Ford, you know, we've got 100 million cars on the road. It's a 110-year-old brand. Most of these models will require this very complex appliance to move people in some shape or form. It's not that easy to do that in size, and I know other companies can do it too. But I think one of our advantages is our belief that this is more of an opportunity than a threat. In a way, it's kind of liberating to participate in these new markets. So that's the way we're approaching it. As Mark said, there's a lot of work to do. I think we've given you sort of the essence of our thinking so far. But we recognize that we've got to translate that essence, that aspiration, some of the early developments into business models that drive growth, risk, and returns. And that's the message here. We know that it's prospective growth, risk, and returns that matter, and that's how we're thinking about this opportunity.
Mark, can I add something to that? And we're talking about sharing vehicles, but the other aspect, of course, is sharing data. Now, I've got a 19 and a 22-year-old. They share data that I wouldn't dream of sharing. And as we become, you know, obviously our core business, which will become more and more connected, and the emerging services, we start from the premise that the customer owns the data. But if we can add value to their lives, and Ford Pass is part of that, we think that they will allow us to use the data, and there's value in that data. I think it's also generational. It's clear that younger generations than me are more prepared to share. And then initially when we ask questions, would you borrow a car or a truck? The answer was yes. Would you share one? No. But if you go down the generations, actually that's becoming more and more acceptable. And I think we'll be quite surprised as we move through the generations.
Joe, you want to take the second question?
Actually, if I could just follow up on that. I guess just more directly, why Ford and not Uber or Lyft or Google or someone else that actually aspires and is currently working on developing these kinds of network solutions as well? Is there any reason why Ford will necessarily have competitive advantages as that develops?
Well, you know, it might not be or, it might be and, because I think it's going to take a lot of different kinds of skills to deliver these models. So, you know, give us a little time, but I think it's going to be a, like the technology world today, you know, the counterparty can be a customer, a collaborator, and a competitor at the same time.
And, you know, just on that, we'll talk more about this in 2016, but, you know, think about some of the data that we talked about. You know, by the end of the decade, we'll have 43 million sync-equipped vehicles. We'll have 10 million vehicles equipped with 4G LTE modems. That offers a lot of opportunity. Not only think about it from the ride-sharing aspect, but think about how people spend time in their vehicles, right? They spend 4 hours on, we've done the surveys. We do lots of surveys, right, as a company. People spend about 4.5 hours each year in our dealerships. you know, for an oil change or, you know, whatever service they need. They spend 900 hours in their vehicle. That's a lot of opportunity for us going forward. Joe?
Okay. North America, certainly start out by recognizing the kind of strong performance and the starting base that we have in 2015. And the guidance that we've given on the 9.5 or, you know, a greater operating margin, go back a year, in, you know, at this point in time last year, we were saying 8.5% to 9.5%, looking at what was going on in the industry, and we've been able to do better than that, taking advantage of opportunities, even with a, frankly, more expensive UAW contract in the contract in the calendar year than we expected going into it. And you look at the elements of 2016 versus 2015, we've noted that we think the industry will be in that 17.5 to 18.5 range, so roughly, you know, where it was or perhaps a little bit better than last year. So that's the market factors should be a positive effect for 2016 volume, market share, pricing with some of the new products. There is some contribution cost that comes with all the new products full year from last year, plus the new products this year. There's some pretty significant launches this year, Super Duty being probably the most paramount for Ford and, of course, the Continental for Lincoln. There's probably more launches in 16 than people were really keeping into perspective with Fusion, Escape, et cetera. But when you look at it from a cost standpoint year over year, D&A will be up. Our spending's been up the last several years compared to D&A, and we'll see that continuing given the investments we're making in the business and all the capital investments we've made to support the F-150 transition to aluminum, the Super Duty transition, other new products. We are continuing to invest in the core business, as Mark has mentioned several times, and we see opportunity to continue to invest in the product portfolio that we have and perhaps look at enhancements to that, including keeping our product lineup one of the freshest in the industry, which has served us well on the transaction price and margin side of things. And we're also going to be spending a little bit more money on these new initiatives that we're talking about, which we think are worth investing in, whether it's, you know, the Ford Pass and Ford Hub and Ford Guides and a number of things around smart mobility. There'll be some increased costs in 2016 on that. So obviously we'll start out with an opportunity to do as well as we can in 2016, look for those opportunities. We're operating at one of the highest levels of profitability in North America of any manufacturer, so clearly we're proud of those results, but we'll look for opportunities to do better. If the industry continues to perform at the mix it's been running at and the levels we're running at, certainly we'll look for opportunities on pricing, and transaction prices have been strong, and we'll look for those opportunities for 2016.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. John?
Maybe just to follow up on the North American margin question, I mean, are you basically saying that the 9.5 to 10.5% that you're guiding to for 15, as we think about 16, is sort of an asymptotic limit, or, you know, is it really just a 9.5% or better, and we're just starting the year off, and you're going to see how everything works out?
Well, as you see from our guidance, we said 9.5% or higher.
Higher. Yeah.
And as Joe mentioned, as you look at our track record, right, we lay out what our objective is, and we always try to improve based on, you know, when it matter what the world throws at us. And, you know, Joe and the team will continue to do that. But, you know, 9.5% is what we're guiding to or higher.
Okay. Then a second question on the special dividend. I mean, this is a little bit earlier than I think a lot of us were expecting based on previous commentary. I mean, how should we really think about the level of the special dividend? Because, I mean, if you're generating free cash flow that's in the same ballpark as 15 and 16, it seems like you'll have a lot more flexibility to pay an even larger special dividend next year. But what are the financial metrics you're thinking about, and, you know, what market conditions are you thinking about? How are you really calculating that special dividend?
Yeah, well, we look at a number of different things. Mark talked about factors. So we look at the cash balances, and they're very healthy. And I think as we get further in the cycle, that's something we're going to look at even more closely. When you think about the second factor is around net income, so we're looking at, you know, last year's net income, what does this type of supplemental dividend look like relative to that? And when he talked about going forward, that could result in it increasing or decreasing, certainly as we go into a downturn, that would influence us in terms of it being less and potentially at the, you know, the worst part of a recession, nothing. And as we continue to go up, and if the results continue to improve, that could be more. We're looking at funding opportunities to grow the business elsewhere. We would always put that first ahead of a supplemental cash dividend. But as we look at the landscape right now, we think that we are fully funding the business and all the opportunities that we think that we're capable of really going after in 2016. So I think you can check that box. And then last is just looking at the global external environment. You know, what is it like, the volatility, the risk that we see out there, the opportunities that we see out there. So we kind of looked at all those factors together and decided, along with the support and advice of the board, that we felt a 40% increase on top of the regular dividend, which now, because of, you know, where the stock price is as well, has got an extremely healthy yield, is appropriate.
Sounds a little bit like Fed speak. So
no wonder I understand.
No, it's,
so
it's
well.
Good news. I mean, and then just lastly, as you think about this changing ecosystem with the customer, does market share become more or less sticky as this environment develops over time?
Well, I think market share is still, it's an important metric because, you know, there's a certain level that you want for critical mass. But at the same time, as we've said, you know, over the last number of years, we are managing this business for profitability. And so, you know, it may offer us, we've been a business model. Let me put it this way. We've been a business model as a company for 113 years, which has been around how many units we've sold, manufactured and sold. We're also now injecting a business model around vehicle miles traveled, right? Getting to that chart around transportation. And so that's the way we're thinking about this.
And Mark, our share could have been X higher than it we recorded in 15 if we elected to do business that we didn't think made sense for us. So we're not, you know, share is an interesting metric and an important one, but it's not the key one for driving the business.
And I think lastly, the proof point is in 2015, we were able to grow our global market share and we were able to grow our revenue and we were able to grow our margin. Right over there.
Thanks. Ryan Brinkman from J.P. Morgan.
Hey, Ryan.
Could you just talk about your business in China in 4Q? There was, of course, a massive resurgence there. You've released your unit sales results, and they were, of course, they were very good. Delphi earlier today, though, spoke to some inefficiencies that they saw in trying to meet that demand. Just curious if you saw anything similar. And then on a go-forward basis, how are you trying to determine, you know, how much of that rebound was the market genuinely turning a corner rather than, say, you know, pull ahead from future periods?
Well, I can't speak to what the supplier mentioned about inefficiencies. I don't quite understand that. But, you know, as we look at the market, clearly there were a lot of customers in the summer months that delayed purchases because of what was going on with the stock market from a consumer confidence standpoint, since there's not a lot of folks that actually own shares in China. But we saw a good fourth quarter, as you saw from our sales numbers. Our sales were up 27% in December and 3% for the full year. We think that the purchase tax reduction of the 1.6 liter or lower, which is about 70% of our lineup, provides a good incentive to keep the industry at a moderately growing level in 2016. And the government put that in place specifically to stimulate the market. So, you know, we're just going to continue to execute our strategy, which is we're going to have a full year, keep in mind, of launches of some of our newer products like Edge and Taurus, which essentially launched at the very back end of last year, and continue to manage the business appropriately. So, you know, we're still, the market's going to go through its volatility, right? It's going from a investment-led and industry-led economy to a consumption-led one. And if you look at the consumption piece of GDP, that's actually growing, which is a good sign. And we'll continue to manage appropriately and grow the business at the appropriate rate.
Okay, thanks. And then just last question on the North America margin. You know, you held that conference call because of the pension gain that you recorded in the first three quarters of this year. I think it was like $700 million plus or something. So the new sort of implied North America margin for 2015, I think, equates to something like 9.5 to 10.5%. And now you guide to 9.5% or higher in 2016. I just want to make clear for the investors, I think there's a little bit of confusion. Are these not really comparable numbers because you're not assuming any sort of gains in 2016? Or what is happening if you strip away all the pension noise to sort of underlying margins in North America, 16 versus 15? Thanks.
Well, let me just add to what Joe said, then he can circle back if he wants to. We basically, I think with the announcement of the mark-to-market change relative to pensions, what we've done is we've drawn the curtain back on the true underlying operating performance and the strength of North America and Europe and the company. And as a result of that, you've seen a one-point rise in the margin for North America. So we were operating at very strong levels, as Joe said, I think over the last 6 years, we have been the strongest in North America. And we've basically, that's been dragged back a bit from the way that we had accounted for pensions. The real underlying performance was stronger. You can now see that. So it's about a point higher. So if you think about through the first 9 months, we actually did post-mark-to-market a 10.9% margin. We had said that we expect the fourth quarter to be a bit weaker in part because of the UAW. That's still the case. But we're still going to have a good margin in the fourth quarter, lower than the year-to-date numbers. So the full-year number is going to be quite healthy, you know, sort of in the upper half of that revised 9.5% to 10.5% range. So when you think about what we're talking about going forward, as you said, 9.5% or better, that's still at the very top end of the range that we've always guided to for North America, which is 8% to 10%. So it's an extremely strong margin, and we do expect opportunities as we continue to work through the year. It's very early. We have 12 months ahead of us, and we're going to try to work through every opportunity we can, as we did this past year, and yield a margin as strong as we can, albeit coming from a very strong level. And as he said, a lot of this is around the cost that we're investing in the business, not only for the launches in 2016, but also investments that we're making to support Ford Smart Mobility, and again, of course, incremental investments for products and services down the road. So very, very strong, and frankly, we've just taken a whole water level up going forward.
Okay, how about over here? Let's get this side of the room. I'll make the guy with the microphone walk. Boy, this is a tough crowd. It's only the end of the first night.
Hey, Mark. It's Jonas. Adam Jonas. Sorry.
Who? Adam.
So earlier, I think I'll quote, when discussing some of the issues about technological change, you said, and I quote, we look at this as a huge opportunity for us. Can I, if you look at a lot of people in the room here, if you ask them, why your stock is trading where it is, and it seems like there's at least some in the market that might look at that, the other side of that. I know it's a very media-focused week, and you want to put a brave face on things, and you want to, you know, come at things very positively and a good attitude. But if I asked you to put a negative spin on it, could you? Because I could show you videos from Kodak, Barnes & Noble, Blockbuster, and BlackBerry, at events like this, saying very similar things. We're going to turn this into a strength. Digital imaging is a massive opportunity for Kodak. So I'm only asking that. I'm sorry to be a downer here, but I'm just asking this so we can understand in this room, do you at least recognize the dark side of this?
Well, thanks for the question, Adam. I know Adam a long time, so we'll see you outside. No. Listen, I appreciate the question. And first off, I actually take, what's the word, umbrage to the comment of do we really get it, and, you know, showing videos of Kodak, et cetera. And the reason for that is hopefully what you're seeing from us is a very forward-leaning look on this. To be able to say, you saw the way we're representing the business, the core and this emerging. And the reason for that is because we're looking at these societal changes. Any business, it gets back to having a business that's taking a point of view in the world 5-10 years from now. And we're looking at these societal factors, right? The growth of the megacities, the growth of the global middle class, the pollution, the changing, you know, consumer behaviors. And we're saying as a management team, hey, that's going to impact some part of our business. Do we want to stick our heads in the sand and ignore it? Or do we want to challenge custom and question tradition and actually look at the capital that we have in the business and apportion levels of that to go after this? And in some case, looking at it through the lens, if we look at this, some of these things through the lens of how we evaluate the core business, they won't get any traction at all, right? So I think as a management team, that's why, for example, we set up a research and innovation center in Silicon Valley. We don't think flying in there and being a transactional company is actually going to be enough. We're there. We have over 100 professionals there, so we're part of the community. And a lot of the things that you've seen us announce literally over the last couple of weeks have been because we're viewed as part of the community. So we get it. We've seen the companies that I didn't look at their investor presentations, but I think we're really looking at these societal factors, taking that point of view in the world. And it goes back to how we run the business. We've talked about this in multiple forums, right? Our creating value roadmap process. Every Thursday morning, we are sitting around as a management team and going through the complete business in 2.5 hours. And the first chart that comes up in every business unit and every skill team is the business environment. And I got to tell you, every week, there's something happening, right? From established competitors, new competitors, technology, customers, government, et cetera. So we are taking this very, very seriously as a company. And we want to lead in it. And that means in some cases we're going to do things on our own. In other cases, we're going to partner with others. And as we do that, we're going to do it in a way that creates value for the company and enhances our brand. What over here?
Hello. Oh, sorry. Oh. If I could jump in real quick. You know, I think you guys think about the autonomous cars way over here.
Oh, okay.
More than anybody, and just would like to get your opinion on how the transition is going to happen. Let's say 10 years from now, the autonomous vehicles are perfected and it works. Would, in your opinion, the government force this thing to happen? Or would it be the market saying, hey, look, we're saving money on insurance and deaths. This is the right thing to do. And either way, as people adopted it, would that cause the cost of a regular car, because there's less of them being built, to skyrocket? Or will your car be able to be an autonomous car or switch to regular mode whenever you want? And I know it's just an opinion, but I just want to know how you look at it. What do you think is going to happen?
Boy, there's about five or six things in there. I think I'm going to turn that over to Raj.
I think it was six. So, you know, obviously very difficult to anticipate what it's going to look like. But, you know, starting from the beginning, the walk up through the autonomy and, you know, from an engineering point of view, we look at it, probably the best classifications are the Society of Automotive Engineers classifications, the level 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. A lot of what you hear about on what's being called autonomous, to be frank, we would not call autonomous from an engineering point of view. We'd call it semi-autonomous. Driver assist technology is getting to semi-autonomy. The key aspect of it is being that at some point in that drive, the vehicle is going to hand over control to the driver. And if you start out with that assumption, we don't believe that should be called full autonomy. And some of the systems you see, Tesla Autopilot is probably an example, we would classify it level 3 semi-autonomous. Level 4 full autonomy, i.e. get in the vehicle from your start point to your destination, get out of the vehicle, never having touched the controls, full autonomy. It starts at level 4, and we think level 4 being in a geofenced area, heavy, high-definition 3D maps, and with climate conditions that are conducive to the sensor suite that the vehicle requires, we think that's possible within 4 years. Level 5 is harder to predict because the degree of complexity of handling driving without that 3D map and handling it in all weather conditions requires some technology breakthroughs that we don't have clear line of sight to. But if you're assuming level 4 is doable by somebody in 4 years, the assumption is also that it has to be doable with the rest of the vehicles around you not being autonomous, that they're actually just being driven as they are right now. Average age of the fleet is 10 years, so you can do the math at how long it takes to change over. We believe also it has to be doable without vehicle-to-vehicle infrastructure, without vehicle-to-infrastructure regulations as well. So basically the environment that we're in right now, we're shooting for technology can develop level 4 within that time frame. So if you walk that out to 10 years, we don't think it's likely that, you know, there would be a mandate from the government that everything has to be autonomous because it just takes too long to change a fleet over to that extent. And even with real reduction in the sensor technology and the processing capability, et cetera, it's still quite a bit of incremental cost. You know, we're not talking just seat belts and airbags. Having said that, there's going to be tremendous societal benefits, whether it's safety, whether it's congestion, whether it's emissions. And so, we're still working with regulatory agencies. We're going to work together, hopefully as an industry and on all parties and all stakeholders to develop the regulations that make sense. But the preliminary discussions we've had with those regulators is they see those benefits. You know, we need to prove the capability, we need to prove the robustness, we need to prove the safety, but they do see those benefits, and then they've been really proactive in doing that. I still see a strong demand for the base vehicles, you know, based on accessibility and affordability of the actual purchase of vehicles. And so I still see that in a volume and a scale that I wouldn't anticipate any penalties to a person who wants to drive a non-autonomous vehicle for whatever the reason may be, and accessibility may be one of those key reasons. So I don't see a penalty within that, but I think that can operate in conjunction with the autonomous vehicle. I also see an aspect where you could have a vehicle that's fully autonomous and that's all it can do, or an aspect of a vehicle that in a geofenced area it can be autonomous. And if you'd like to use that vehicle outside of that area, that we would have the manual controls in the vehicle so it could be what we would call a dual-use vehicle. So I think all of those aspects are in the future in that 10-year horizon.
It was right here. Yeah.
I think I got six of them. Was that six that I answered?
thank you. Stephen Reitman from Société Générale in London. Diesels had a little bit of coverage. Obviously, it's an important in Europe for Ford, as is for the other European manufacturers as well. To what extent was it in your future plans in the U.S. as well to meet EPA 2025, and how do you think is the future as well in Europe, particularly as we get closer to real-world driving?
So great question. Relative to the North American plans, as you're probably aware, the emissions requirements are, as you're probably aware now, the emissions requirements are different in the U.S., and that's certainly something that's been highlighted by the issues with VW. And so, therefore, when we did the math on many of the diesel implementation opportunities, the math just simply didn't work. The cost of the incremental emissions equipment that we felt was necessary to achieve emissions compliance didn't result in an overall save for the consumer with the increased fuel economy, particularly at diesel versus gasoline prices where they are in the U.S. That ratio can be different in other countries, and Europe being one of those. So the math can work out differently. And so it's still a little bit early to see where consumer sentiment's going to be. And so maybe a little bit early even to see what regulatory reaction is going to be in Europe. But right now we still see a strong future for diesel and continue to invest in that in Europe. Maybe some incremental diesel opportunities here, depending on, you know, particularly for something like Super Duty or something where you're into a heavy payload and high load situation a lot of the time, diesel loses less fuel economy under heavy loads than a gas engine does. So it makes sense for people who are towing, or makes sense for people with high payloads. But the other applications, we don't see a big penetration in the U.S., but still see it's going to play a part in Europe. I think that will depend a little bit on how the regulatory agencies react. The other thing that's being highlighted, you know, within all of this aspect of you know, VW actually putting in a defeat device, which is, you know, certainly, I can't even comprehend, we wouldn't even comprehend doing that, right? We do not use defeat devices, period. But this may draw increased scrutiny on diesel performance relative to overall emissions and particularly particulates, which it does have some disadvantages versus gas. And if this drives a regulatory change there, we'll obviously react to that, and fortunately have some very good gas technologies that are available to us in our portfolio to deploy should that happen.
Brian? Right over here. Yep. There you go. We'll get you next. I got to be equal, you know. I don't want to be accused of being left or right, so let's go over here.
Question from the right wing. Rather than debate the future disruptive mobility and whether you're going to be a Kodak or perhaps more encouragingly a Bell Atlantic, which of course is Verizon, who's, even though the landline business is probably dead. I want to kind of talk about the core business, and I think a lot of people around the room, you know, back to Bob's question to Bob, you know, let's say you're 10-ish percent this year, 9.5% or better next year. Just, you know, a lot of us, I think, coming into it said, okay, full year of F-150, steel prices have collapsed, copper prices have collapsed, aluminum prices, I hear you have a truck made of aluminum, have collapsed. Why isn't that coming into account? I'm trying to also maybe could have elaborated a little bit on your pricing is generally, my understanding, includes new content, which then shows up in cost. So could you maybe comment a little bit on, within your guidance, what are you thinking about the, if you will, the nominal or the real pricing, hedonically adjusted, if you will, environment in North America? And is that going to kind of fray as it did in kind of 03, 04, or 05? Or is it R&D for future mobility that you're putting the cost into? And just kind of help us think that, you know,
yeah.
Bridge
so
the
do you want me
years.
To go first and then you add?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, we expect to see volume growth in North America, our North America. We expect positive pricing that will be both content, new vehicle related, as well as pure pricing, because we still see opportunities there. The market is still very disciplined. I know there's been, you know, there's commentary from time to time about that not being the case, but we still see that. We still think that there's opportunities in terms of financing. I think leasing is getting quite high. That continues to go up. We kind of lag that a bit, but we've seen the same sort of level of increase in leasing, but from a lower level. We're still seeing extended payment terms grow. There's probably more there. I do agree there could be some consequences later down the road in terms of, you know, the cycle, but I think that clearly is helping consumers as well. But all of our metrics in Ford Credit, as Mark said in his presentation, look very, very healthy. So we can support and are supporting the business. When we look at you're talking about commodities, we actually see less of a favorable effect. We do see a favorable effect, but a less of a favorable effect this year than what we had last year. I think they're low, but, you know, they're running out of room to fall. At least it would appear, at least based on our forecast. And that is actually pretty much offset this year, which was not the case in 15 versus 14, as Mark said, with more bad news on exchange. We see more bad news on exchange in North America this year than we had last year. So when I put those two together, we had a very positive effect of commodities net of exchange. We're not going to have, we don't see at the moment that effect in 2016. It's pretty neutral, frankly. So then it gets down to cost. And as we said, we don't think we will see a cost increase in material, not as much as last year, but then we will see an increase in our structural costs. Some of that is investments we've already made, continue to make investments in terms of spending that's going up, as you heard from Mark, and then in some of the other areas that we talked about. But, you know, as he talked about with the return on invested capital, we're very focused and very specific in terms of where we're placing our bets, where we're putting the money down, we're making sure we're getting good returns. And so we're very confident that as we continue to invest in business, it is for profitable growth, if not this year, and it will be a good year, if not better than 2015. We certainly are investing for continued strong business going forward.
And maybe just a quick follow-on question for John. You know, these are margins that when you covered Ford Motor, you probably never dreamed of. I mean, post 2000 or so.
Well, I was an analyst a long time, so
right.
I was there early on in that chart.
These are margins probably the 03, 04 period. So what's in your view as an Excelsider that the market might be missing in terms of the P multiple it's putting against Ford?
You know, I'm not going to make a judgment about what the market's missing. I think this, you know, our business is driven by all this macro stuff, gas prices, interest rates, job growth, income growth. Market's clearly worried when it sees an 18 million unit SAR and low gas prices. And, you know, how can things get better? So I'll leave it up to you. I think we'll work pretty hard at the things we can control. And I feel right now that, you know, we have a very strong product line. Our breaking points come down a lot. And I think probably within the things we can control that matter to the stock price, if we put the Galactic stuff aside, It's the risk part of that risk, return, and growth formula. And, you know, if our break-even point's low, we go through the next cycle and have a better experience, you know, that'll probably be pretty powerful.
And I think that's a key thing to your question. I think the market's looking to see how do we do in the next downturn, right? And we spent a lot of time talking about our break-even in North America and getting the business physically fit, not only to manage the next downturn, but to continue to sustain the dividend. And we look at, you know, other industry, railroads, et cetera, and they were able to prove that, and their multiples improved. So that lesson's not lost on us.
I think the other thing I would add, particularly on the risk, because we talked about in the presentation, you know, at some point, margins don't grow any further. And so we're at a very, very healthy level margin in North America. Will there be quarters where we can do better? I think there will be. But at a 9.5, 10, 10.5, I mean, those are extremely strong margins for a volume manufacturer. I think the opportunity we have is to get the rest of the business to contribute. And the thing that really is exciting to me is the fact that for the first time in a very long time, you know, we've got not only North America, but we've got every other business unit with the exception of South America for understandable reasons moving into the black. And we think that they'll move further into the black in 2015. I think that's a big development. And as we move forward, I think that's a big opportunity for us as a company. Keep North America strong, get the rest of the business contributing more powerfully to the bottom line and the margin of the company.
You know, we just to add one thing. We talk a lot about risk, understandably so. A lot of concerns about where the industry is in the U.S., but there are a number of forecasters and a number of economists who believe there's still upside opportunity in the U.S. market. Now, obviously, last week has got people a week and a half got people a little frazzled, but the fundamentals still support actually a strong economic growth for our industry. If that were to be the case, given the capacities that people have and the pricing that we've seen, there's an argument to be made that there's opportunity in this industry for some time to come if there's no shock or anything crazy, because there's certainly outside forecasters, you know, forecasting 9 million, 19 million even this year. And, you know, given what we're seeing, that could lead to better pricing because there will be capacity constraints perhaps in some products, especially SUVs perhaps. So, you know, the risk will always dominate the discussion, but there's a number of opportunities out there that may, in fact, play out over the course of the year, and we're looking to make sure we're ready for those.
Okay, let's go right here. This gentleman was...
Thank you very much. Pat Archambault from Goldman Sachs. Two questions, really, one more matter of fact and one more longer term, I guess. Just first, on the decision of a supplemental dividend versus a buyback, can you talk to us a little bit more about what the factors were? You know, what would think with a 4.5% dividend yield, a buyback might have looked awful tempting. So just maybe, you know, a little bit more on why you decided to go with the supplemental dividend.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time talking about this, and over the last year we've done a lot of research, we've talked to a lot of advisors, and there's actually been a lot written in the press and the media over the last several months about that. And frankly, the feedback is somewhat mixed. That certainly is an option, and we would never say never to that. But when we look at our ownership base, it's 45% retail. They hold the stock. They don't benefit from getting out of the stock because they don't get out of the stock. They hold the stock. And so when we think about that and the fact that we can provide a great opportunity in terms of rewards for everybody, for us that just seems to be the logical outcome. Again, if there were some event that we thought was extraordinary and we thought it made sense to take advantage of it, then we would. We're not saying no.
Right.
But for us, our ownership base, we think that's the best way to do that.
Okay, understood. And just more strategically, you know, a question on the relevance of brand in the future. You know, when I think about autonomous driving, you know, this is one of these conditions where having a specific brand may be less relevant. Same with, you know, mobility as a service, right? If you're switching vehicles and not owning for a particularly long period of time. So I know this is far out, but is this something that you try and resist and try and find ways to keep the brand relevant? Or can you envision a future where you're kind of a device manufacturer and you don't really care about it? And you know, maybe some of the selling and R&D and product development stuff just doesn't happen in the same way anymore.
Well, as we said before, we do not want to turn into the handset business. That is not a recipe for success. So we do think our brand is one of our most important things. We do think even going on into the future, whether it's ride service, et cetera, brand will play a factor, maybe not as much as privately owned vehicles, but it will. That one of the important things that will play a factor is the kind of features you have in your vehicle, even whether it's a private vehicle or you're in a vehicle of transportation as a service. But the other piece, getting back to what we were talking about earlier, what is the overall customer experience and relationship in terms of how you're using either your product or those services? Are you making it easy for them in an integrated way? For, you know, let's say users that want to maybe just have transportation as a service one day or one week, and then the next week actually want to have a vehicle. So those are the things that we're thinking through, and just don't think of it in terms of just passenger vehicles. What about on the commercial side? What opportunities are there for us in that area? Because, you know, we do have some expertise in that area as well. So these are the lots of factors to think about, but I think we're thinking about the right things in the right strategic time frame. No easy answers.
There's clearly a group today that commoditized transportation, but there are actually growth areas around the world, China being one, where what you drive is pretty much a definition of who you are. So I think brand, from a pure automotive perspective, is going to remain very important. And as Mark said, and we absolutely plan to be part of mobility solutions going forward, which will enhance a consumer experience, that we believe will be very positive flow on everything we do, automotive and emerging mobility services.
Okay, how about in the way in the back there?
Thanks so much. Brings back the song, "Wish I Was a Little Bit Taller." Sorry.
Me too.
So one technical question and maybe one more theoretical question. First, technical. How do we think about CapEx in this sort of entirely different cycle, right? I mean, maintenance and growth take on totally different meanings. And I think the next 5 or 10 years, when investors ask us, what's the maintenance percentage, what's the growth percentage of CapEx, what's the answer as far as you see it? And then a quick, hopefully quick, theoretical follow-up.
You and me?
Well, I mean, I'll just answer first. I mean, what we've said, we're going up a bit this year in the forecast of 7.7, and going forward, going all the way back to Investor Day back in, was that 14? You know, we said we could get up to about $9 billion by the latter part of the decade. And this was as we saw more and more opportunities for us to grow the business. And that was actually probably before we had full line of sight in terms of, you know, the opportunities now. And I think actually the thing that's kind of interesting is we're having really great discussions around being even more targeted and strategic in terms of, you know, where we are going to allocate the capital. So I think, you know, going forward, you'll see growth in the core business that's going to feed that as we find opportunities, if they make sense, to expand the portfolio or take the portfolio into new markets. And then I think you'll see incremental investment for opportunities in the emerging markets or in the emerging, you do the same thing, emerging opportunities. So I think that will just sort of layer in as we go forward. There's some in there this year, probably more in engineering and some of the other expense categories than there is in CapEx. So I think that will grow in CapEx going forward.
We're certainly seeing some of the development expense for those opportunities in this year and in the near-term years. And, you know, in the base, the core business, you know, based on the pace of technology and the pace of emissions improvement, safety improvements, the cycles are shorter, and therefore the capital intensiveness is trending higher. But it's also offset in some of these emerging opportunities. Some of those opportunities are also require significant amounts of capital, but some of them aren't as capital intensive as the core business. So you'll see that in some of the out years.
And just if I may, just a quick follow-up, you know, just maybe to follow on to Pat's question. It seems logical to assume that if we're going to this age of driverless cars, brands mean less. And it also seems, if you look at sort of the fight over bandwidth, right? I mean, if you're a telecom company, you feel like you own the bandwidth to the car. If you're a technology company, you feel like you own the mobility side of it, given the phones, iPhone, Android, whatever have you. Is it more important, maybe is my question, for Ford to go viral with their Ford Pass and all the different sort of inventions that you have to disrupt this space? Or is monetization still the primary focus? I mean, I guess if I walked in here and I said, wow, Ford's marketing themselves as a mobility company all of a sudden, How do I make sure I'm not investing in Friendster and I'm actually investing in Facebook?
So maybe I'll let Stephen answer the Ford Pass aspect of it, but I think it would be important to look at even some of the examples that Adam mentioned. And in those product lines, you know, brand, design, engineering, function, even what it says about your lifestyle, what it says about you, still remains an extremely important part of the purchase decision. And clearly that's been the case in the automotive industry for the entire history of the industry, that you know, despite all the technical data that may be available and you know, astounding amount of information that's available, you could make a very engineering-based decision about what your next vehicle should be. Yet the number one purchase decision for a vehicle still remains exterior styling.
Yeah.
And so it's still an emotional purchase. And for the foreseeable future, we still see that being part of the purchase decision, even with you know, autonomy coming to the forefront and certainly connectivity coming to the forefront. All of those things are further opportunities for differentiation in our mind. If you take it as a user experience, if you take it just for technology's sake and you just focus it on, as we have in the past, on just an engineering delivery of a feature, certainly there's an aspect of commoditization that can happen. But if you really look at what is the user experience you're trying to enable in this future of personal mobility, I believe it's actually an opportunity to strengthen the brand and even further differentiate yourself. And I think even some of the examples that Adam mentioned are proof of that the differentiation was actually very important in establishing brands in those segments.
And on the Ford Pass as an example, if you like, of mobility, as Mark said, we see ourselves existing in automotive and mobility. But that doesn't mean we lose the rigor of our normal capital deployment. I mean, we're treating Ford Pass as if it were a product program. So we know that we've got investment. We also know that we've got return elements because, for instance, the three parking partners that we mentioned, we have a revenue stream, clearly, that comes from that. I won't give you the detail. And as we add more services and more capability, it will be to generate revenue. But it will go through the rigor of capital deployment that you would expect from a Ford Motor Company.
You know, just one more thing before we throw it up to one more question, to your question. There's that old saying, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And to your question of, is it a Friendster or is it a Facebook? You know, in our history, we've gone after some new strategies. And some of you may have remembered those. This time, we have full management alignment around the need to support our core business and what these emerging opportunities mean for us if we act on them, but also what they mean for us if we don't act on them, the impact on our business. We as a team spend a lot of time on this. There's complete management alignment around this. And when you can get a management team and an organization all in agreement about where we're heading and making sure that the core business is maintained and loved and the people that are in that business are developed, and at the same time, the same thing for the emerging opportunities, you can do some very strong things as a company. And I think that is something, if there's one message I'd like to leave you around that, that's a key one. So maybe one more, and let's take it right over there.
I wonder, probably, Raj, what your thinking is on the electrification strategy. I think there was something like $4.5 billion. You got a lofty ROIC goal in there. You got $2 gasoline. What's sort of the thinking? Is this electric cars, hybrids, or some other approach there?
Yeah, it's all three. We're continuing to progress in implementation of hybrid vehicles and plug-in hybrids and as well as full electric. You know, clearly, gas prices where they're at right now and the payback for an electrified vehicle, very difficult to make sense for, and particularly with aspects of recharge time and those aspects of range anxiety that still exist. But at the same time, gas prices are not going to be at this level. To get to the emissions requirements, whether it's here, fuel economy requirements here in the U.S. or CO2 requirements elsewhere in the world, electrification has to be part of that solution. And therefore, you know, we feel that we need to be on the forefront of both in terms of the technology we're introducing, but being also known as having that choice in our vehicles and leading electrification technologies in the vehicles. So as we bring the recharge times down, as we bring the cost per kilowatt hour down, as we bring the ranges up, and it's less of a sacrifice to the consumer, we think we're going to see increased consumer acceptance. In the time frames that we think gas prices will go up, we'll see the value equation start to make more sense for the consumers, and the fact to meet the regulatory requirements. It's a given that a portion of the fleet needs to be electrified. We feel that it's a very smart investment at this point in time, the $4.5 billion, and ensuring that in the 13 nameplates we're talking about, that electrified powertrain is going to be available for the consumer to choose.
Robin?
Thank you again.
Okay. Very good. And thank you for your time.